Today on Wings.
80% of the world's biodiversity exists within recognized indigenous lands and territories, and 85% of the world's conservation and protection zones are adjacent to or within indigenous territories. This is not a coincidence.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The American Public Health Association held its 145th annual meeting in 2017 from November 4th through the 8th in Atlanta. The theme was Creating the Healthiest Nation, Climate Changes Health. Keynote speaker was Ariel Chekwe Durange, a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta, Canada, and a leader in the Indigenous Tar Sands campaign. She addressed 12,000 attendees, mostly from the U.S., but also from 40 other countries. I'm Melinda Tuhus with Wings. I attended the conference and recorded Durange's keynote address, presented here.
Thank you. Eklanete, Dene Sotlane, Arielze Ekwe Husye, Durange Betziani Hesli. My name is Arielze Ekwe Durange, and I'm a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. And I want to thank Dr. Benjamin and the APHA for bringing me here today. I would like to start by acknowledging and giving thanks to the original peoples of this land and territory, the Muscogee Creek and the Cherokee peoples. I would also like to acknowledge the fact that these people were forcibly removed from this territory in the 19th century and now reside in Oklahoma. I would also like to acknowledge the generations of African American slaves that built the state of Georgia. Indigenous people exist everywhere across the globe. We represent approximately 5% of the global population, and roughly 370 million worldwide are recognized as indigenous. We represent over 5,000 distinct groups with our own languages, political, social, and education and institutions that are recognized in over 90 different countries. What's really interesting is that indigenous people's territories, our lands, occupy 22% of the world's land surface. That's in comparison to cities only occupying 3%. I find one of the most intriguing statistics is that 80% of the world's biodiversity exists within recognized indigenous lands and territories, and 85% of the world's conservation and protection zones are adjacent to or within indigenous territories. This is not a coincidence. This is because our identities, who we are as indigenous peoples, is intrinsically linked to the places where we live. Not only are indigenous peoples protecting the biodiversity of the planet, but these areas also overlap with gigatons of carbon sinks critical to climate stabilization. It should also be noted that a number of independent nation states with seats at the UN have less territory and smaller populations than some indigenous populations here in North America. Yet we still struggle for recognition. Yes, it's changing. The United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples was passed in 2007, and it was created in partnership with Indigenous peoples who had a seat at the table, making it the only UN convention that Indigenous peoples had a part of forming. However, and it also creates the foundations for one of the only documents that supports the self-determination and models of free, prior, and informed consent for Indigenous peoples. However, it's not retroactive. The history of the United States is one of real atrocities. In order for us to find collaborative ways to move forward, we're going to have to look back at our collective history. Indigenous peoples used to number in the millions, and now in the United States, it's less than 5 million people are recognized as Indigenous. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz states, "Those who seek a history with an upbeat ending, a history of redemption and reconciliation, may look around and observe that such a conclusion is not visible, not even in utopian dreams of a better society." The history of the United States and Canada alike is one of settler colonialism, rooted in things like white supremacy, African slavery, and policies supported by the church and the state of genocide and land theft. These systems attempted to demonize, devalue, and extinguish Indigenous peoples' languages, political and cultural structures, and ideological perspectives and way of life. All of this with the end goal of erasing us from the landscape and human consciousness. Now is the time that we abandon patriarchal and colonial ideologies rooted in things like the doctrine of discovery, terra nullius, and manifest destiny. We have always been here, and we were never discovered.
We're listening to the keynote speech from Canadian Indigenous activist Ariel Duranger at the 2017 American Public Health Association's annual meeting in Atlanta.
I could talk about that because my mom's American, but I do live in Canada and I'm a Canadian citizen, so I digress. I come from this territory. I come from a place called Treaty 8 in northern Alberta, where in Canada, Indigenous people represent about 4% of the population, or 1.4 million people. My people are known as the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, which is a colonial name. Our real name was the Kaikale Dene Sot Lene, which means the people of the willow, which gives reference to the Athabasca Delta in which where we're from. But more importantly, I want to discuss what it means to be Dene. Melissa Daniels and a member of my nation stated that the word Dene, when translated, is broken down into two words, De, meaning flow, and Ne, meaning Mother Earth. This encompasses an understanding that we as Dene people flow from Mother Earth, and we are people of the Creator and creation. The land is the very essence of who we are. It nurtures our bodies, our minds, our cultures, and our connection to our role on this planet Earth, Mother Earth. I want my children to know what it means to be Dene. I want this picture and these experiences of mine not to be relics of the past, but something to be celebrated by future generations. When I look at this photo, I can remember the smell of the prairie grass and the sounds of the drums and my language being spoken. I want those memories to be cherished and shared by my own children. But that is all being threatened right now because of global climate change. Humanity is facing a global crisis. Climate change. Indigenous people are not only threatened by the colonial ideologies and policies to eradicate our civil and human rights, but our very cultures and our identities are threatened by man-made climate change, precipitated by colonial ideologies rooted in things like capitalism. We're witnessing coastlines rising, floods, out-of-control forest fires, and species disappearing, changing weather patterns. And it's these impacts that are being disproportionately felt by communities least responsible for climate change and those that are most vulnerable in society, like communities like my own. We must find solutions that recognize the fundamental rights of all people to create a just future. We must discuss the drivers of climate change, not just the solutions. My community now lives in the township of Fort Chipewyan, which is a northern fly-in community in northern Alberta. Fly-in means that the only way in and out is by plane, unless it's winter, for 3 months of the year you can drive, and in the spring and summer, which is about 4 months of the year, you can take a boat. This requires our people to rely quite heavily on traditional food sources, hunting, fishing, and trapping. But right now, my people's lands and territories is under threat from the largest industrial project on planet Earth, the Alberta oil sands. This is not your sweet conventional crude oil. It's thicker, like peanut butter, and at room temperature, when it's extracted from the ground, is almost as hard as a rock. It has a relatively higher concentration of nitrogen, sulfur, and heavy metals. And it's the pace and scale of this development that makes it out of control. 10% of the world's oil reserves exist in my people's traditional territory. 10%. Over 96% of Canada's total oil reserves are contained within the traditional territories of the Dene, the Cree, and the Métis people. Dr. David Schindler, a renowned biologist in Alberta, stated, "There is nothing on this planet that compares with the destruction going on there. If there were a prize for unsustainable development, the tar sands would be a clear winner." Currently, over 900 square kilometers of land have been disturbed for tar sands mining. Over 4,000 square kilometers have been leased out to projects right now. Currently, the industry uses 170 billion liters, not million, billion liters of water, fresh water, every single year, and this is only expected to increase. This fresh water ends up in toxic tailings ponds that now cover 260 square kilometers of land, held in place with some of the world's largest earthen dams. Not concrete, not plastic, earthen dams. And since operations began, more than 1.3 trillion liters of tailings have accumulated in these tailings ponds. That is enough toxic tailings to fill up 400,000 Olympic swimming pools. The dewatering and the contamination of these ecosystems is a threat to the security, food security, and livelihoods of my people. And every day, these toxic tailings leach into our river systems, contaminating our water systems, contaminating our foods. However, mining is not even the only accessible method. The other 80%, because 20% is mining, is in situ. And in situ is similar to fracking, in so much that you steam and you put pressure into the ground. And in this case, we're superheating fresh water and diluents or solvents at high pressure, injecting them into the ground to melt the bitumen so that underlying pipelines can suck it back up and ship it off to refineries. In the end, in-situ operations require more energy and generate 2.5 times as much greenhouse gas per barrel than mining operations. But industry says they do use less water. So the reality is these projects are actually leaving a larger environmental footprint than open pit mining, taking up 80% of the land of the 140 square kilometers of land, 140,000 square kilometers of land. These projects now represent 31% more emissions than the average conventional crude oil, and they're the fastest single growing emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. They create more emissions than all the cars on the road combined in the country, Canada, not the United States. And they stand as a barrier for us meeting our climate commitments. In addition to creating massive amounts of emissions, they're also destabilizing and reducing the potential of carbon sequestration and releasing stored carbon into the atmosphere. Dr. Rebecca Rooney, a biologist who trained under Dr. Schindler, conducted a study in 2012, oil sands mining and reclamation caused massive loss to peatland and stored carbon. We're reducing the ability of this land to sequester carbon by in the thousands and thousands of metric tons annually. But reclamation, industry says, oh, we love the landscape, we love the environment, we care about the future, and we'll reclaim it. And to add insult to injury, to date, less than 0.02% of all tar sands operations have been certified reclaimed. We have lost generations of use of land because of these operations that began in the 1960s. There are over 5,200 leases in the region. And this isn't one company, this isn't one place, this isn't one big bad guy. It's every multinational corporation in the world. 80% of the world's oil and gas is actually state-owned, and the other 20% is open to private sectors, and of that 20%, half of it is in my people's traditional territory where we have no say over how they're going to utilize this land. We have created the largest industrial project on Earth, with hundreds of billions of dollars invested, and infrastructure that touches coast to coast to coast to coast of the entire continent of North America, with international and national interests from across the globe. It has created a situation where small nations like my own, of less than 2,000 people, are pitted up against large multinational corporations and government and economic interests that we have no chance of fighting. The battle over the tar sands has come down to a fundamental right to exist as Indigenous peoples and a climate-stable future versus corporate and capitalistic rights to develop. This continues models of colonization through the industrialization of our lands and territory that exacerbate global climate change. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. Tar sands don't just exist in Canada, they exist everywhere. And Canada's this G8 country that is supposed to be setting the standards. We're in the COP23 right now, proudly talking about how we're going to do everything we can to meet the global climate commitments. Yet here we are, a G8 country setting the standards for what it means to develop bottom-of-the-barrel oil and gas, what it means to meet climate commitments, what it means to respect and implement Indigenous people's rights. My country has a moral responsibility to do better so that we do not see this type of oil developed across the globe.
This is Ariel Chekwi Duranger of Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta and a leader in the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. She spoke at the November 2017 American Public Health Association annual meeting in Atlanta.
Climate change alone is expected to threaten the extinction of approximately one quarter or more of all species on land by the year 2050, surpassing even habitat loss as the biggest threat to life on land. We are a species on planet Earth, let's not forget that. Indigenous peoples we are raised to know that we are a part of everything, that the moose and the caribou and the eagles and the fish are our relatives. They are our cousins, they are our ancestors. We have no more rights to anything than they do. And we are seeing both habitat loss and climate change impacting some of the most critical species in our territory. My territory, which is also home to UNESCO World Heritage Site called Wood Buffalo National Park, is home to the last wild flock of whooping cranes. That summer, and breed in my territory, and then winter in the Gulf Coast. So they're like getting it on both ends. And they're threatened. Woodland caribou in our traditional territory are not just being threatened by industrial development, they've reduced by over 80% since the year 2000 when the big boom in the oil sands took off. And now they're being threatened by climate change, reducing their food sources. We're seeing less moose, we're seeing less waterfowl. All of these things threatening the ability for Indigenous peoples to continue practicing their subsistence lifestyles, their daily and cultural activities on the land. In addition to habitat loss and climate change impacts, our food sources are already threatened by contamination and degradation caused by the tar sands industry. The picture of the ducks. In 2008, a flock of over 1,600 ducks landed on an open tailings pond because, I'll remind you, 260 square kilometers of land are now open tailings ponds, mistaking it for an open lake, and they all died. Fish in downstream and surrounding bodies of water are now seen with deformities and high levels of contaminants. And the picture on your far left is a beheaded bison. As new people enter our territory for employment, we're now seeing that they're not just coming here for employment, but they are coming there with the same mentality to take whatever they want and devaluing the cultures of Indigenous peoples. And we are seeing overhunting and trophy hunting and the desecration of our lands and species. This bison was found by one of the community members. And when he found this bison, he cried. This is a sacred animal that is only hunted at certain times of the year and has the potential to feed four families for an entire season in a community that is fly-in and depends on these food sources. Colonization isn't something that's happened. It's happening today still. As we see the disappearance of our food security caused by both the drivers of climate change and climate change, we're being forced to consume Western foods that are only available at the single grocery store in our community called the Northern, where a gallon of milk is almost $17, where a loaf of Wonder Bread is $8, where produce is both lacking and, when available, overpriced. This is leading people to being unable to afford good, healthy food, and we're seeing implications of real health challenges in our community. It's also forcing us to participate in the very economic systems that are destroying our lands and our food security. And this, of course, ultimately has impacts on our health. We have lower life expectancies. We're seeing increases of obesity because of bad food choices, diabetes because of bad food choices. We're seeing autoimmune diseases, respiratory diseases caused by climate change and the drivers of climate change. And what's even worse is our communities is dealing with some of the worst kinds and cases of cancer, where we have seen 6 cases of bile duct cancer that are linked to the contaminants found in the oil and gas industry. We are literally dying. We are dying so that people can have oil and gas. And I'd like to ask you a question. Who thinks is our biggest client for this oil? Who? America. You guys. The United States of America is our biggest client. More than ever, we need to move towards decolonizing not just the environment, but decolonizing our solutions. We need to challenge our own systems and look for ways to incorporate and work with Indigenous peoples and the knowledge systems that they have held onto for millennia. Indigenous peoples are exercising our sovereign rights to implement our own environmental and health infrastructures, to regulate and enforce our own laws within our lands and territories, as defined by the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Articles 3 and 10. We are our own experts. We are doctors, biologists, scientists, educators, and we have the fundamental right to exist and build our own systems in partnership with our settler partners. And a lot of people ask me, well, what does decolonization mean? Decolonization is about the return of and connection to land. And decolonization isn't just for Indigenous peoples, it's for all of us. We all need to return to the land. The land houses our medicines, it houses our water, it houses our food. It literally gives us life. And we must find ways to return to those places to find the answers for climate change. It's been recognized the world over that Indigenous lives and livelihood model some of the more progressive and successful low-carbon lifestyles. Moreover, Indigenous peoples have been critical to the protection and preservation of some of the world's richest biodiverse regions. But we have to move past the rhetoric that we are agents of change. The two pictures here are from Paris in 2015 and Copenhagen in 2009 at the climate negotiations. And there's not much difference between the two because not much changed in there. Indigenous people still don't have a seat at the table in climate negotiations. We still don't have a seat at the table in making and proposing solutions to address climate change. We need to move past this. We need to find ways to integrate knowledge systems. Indigenous peoples are at the front lines to challenge both the drivers of climate change and pushing for the solutions. It's easy to forget that Indigenous communities have faced centuries of systemic oppression that has robbed us of our ability to easily enter local and national and international forums where policies and decisions are being made that affect our rights and survival. As we all attempt to find solutions to work together, we must address the root causes of climate change, the drivers, and the policies and oppressive policies that have got us to where we are today. Our people have the legal and moral authority to stand up and challenge these systems, and we have a deep spiritual connection to this place we call Mother Earth. We need to make sure that we don't just support communities across Turtle Island that are challenging the drivers of climate change, but also find ways to look at our own work and our places of privilege and push back and look for ways of integrating decolonized methods of research and partnerships and put an end to the colonial practices that have left Indigenous peoples and people of color on the sidelines. The world has come together to create the Paris Agreement. And even within the text of the Paris Agreement and its decisions, it contains important references to Indigenous peoples' rights that can help drive change at the local level where it's needed most. And that's because the former president of the United Nations even stated that Indigenous peoples interpret and react to the impacts of climate change in creative ways, drawing on traditional knowledge and other technologies to find solutions that society at large can replicate to counter pending changes. And our communities are already doing that. We're taking models of Indigenous cultures, lives, and lifestyles, and trying to find energy solutions that work. We're combining Western science and Indigenous knowledge to build energy security and sovereignty, and not just capitalist energy models. We're looking for solutions that respect our relationships to the land, and we are living proof that anything is possible. I just want to end it with, if we leave traditional ecological knowledge and Indigenous peoples out of the discourse on climate change and climate solutions, it's a recipe for disaster. If our communities are not active participants in creating pathways for a just future, we will continue to be oppressed and play a marginalized role and further divide our connection to land and this place on Mother Earth. It's time for world leaders and leaders like yourself in this room to decolonize our research, to look at our role in the health sector and allow Indigenous knowledge and peoples, Indigenous peoples and their systems to be incorporated into our work and then allow us to find solutions that respect Indigenous peoples as their own leaders for self-determination. Right now, my colleague Heather Milton-Lightning is at the COP23 in Bonn, Germany, and she took this as a quote from the forum yesterday. Indigenous peoples are here to change the rules, not abide by them. I want to change the game so that my children have a chance. Climate may change our health, but it also presents us with an opportunity to start anew. Let's carve a pathway together for a climate-stable future and an equitable future for all. Thank you. Musi Cho.
That was Ariel Deranger, a member of the Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta and a leader of the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. She was the keynote speaker at the 2017 American Public Health Association annual meeting in Atlanta in November. I'm Melinda Tuhus for Wings.
Ariel Deranger is Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action. For news of their work, visit IndigenousClimateAction.com. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including Jinx Houston, Carolyn Byerly, your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.